This is Director Chris Rodriguez of the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, and I want to welcome you to Season 2 of Intelligence Unclassified. This season, we are refocusing our episodes to better reflect NJOHSP's three core mission areas: counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and emergency preparedness. We'll be pulling both local and national experts in all these fields in an effort to discuss New Jersey's diverse threat landscape and to offer you a unique perspective on current homeland security trends and issues. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show notes and on our website, www.njhomelandsecurity.gov.
Hello, everyone. This is Dean Barada from the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. Today, we've got a different kind of podcast for you. We are at the International Studies Association Conference in Baltimore, and myself, along with two analysts, Paige Schilling and Angie Gadd, are going to sort of recap the highlights of the conference sort of in terms of what we find. So just to give you a little bit of background first, though, the International Studies Association conference brings together researchers from all around the world to discuss their findings in hundreds of panels. Now, the vast majority of those don't relate to our mission, but there are dozens throughout the week that are related to terrorism, intelligence, and homeland security. And so we come here in an effort to meet those researchers from around the world, see what new research they're doing, and then we go back to New Jersey and figure out how that applies to our mission, which is keeping the residents of New Jersey safe and understanding the terrorist threat out there. So today is the end of day one. We each saw three or four panels. We're going to talk about the highlights of those each and then have some concluding thoughts. So I'll pass it over to Paige to talk about her first panel.
Great. Hi, everyone. So I'd like to brief you on one of the panels that I sat in on, and it was titled Fake Terrorism, Characteristics of Terrorism Hoax Perpetrators. And this was a piece by Nicole Tischler. She is a PhD candidate at Carleton University in Canada. So what I found really interesting about her piece is that, yes, it was academic, and yes, it was regarding terrorist organizations, but I think a lot of what she went over can be pulled specifically into the state of New Jersey and into the United States. So she considered what are hoaxes, and by that she means anthrax letters that don't really have any biological weapon in them or bomb scares. So she was like, why do terrorist organizations employ hoaxes? What's the purpose of a hoax compared to an actual attack? So she was basically saying that hoaxes are low cost, they're low risk, but there's potentially high payoffs, right? So you're expending resources from law enforcement. There's a certain amount of psychological implications for citizens, but there's no real damage done by the terrorist organizations in terms of lethality. And she said it's a good opportunity for groups that have unwillingness to carry out serious terrorism, and that can explain most of hoax behavior. But she really wanted to get into the motivations behind it. So she had two explanations. The first was that it was a rational choice. So it was a cost-benefit analysis. So the organization would say, it is in the best interest, cost-wise, for my organization to perpetrate a hoax. Or it was motivated by ideology. So in that sense, maybe a group didn't want to actually harm anyone, but wanted to get their point across through a hoax scare or a bomb scare or whatever it may be. So she did a lot of conceptual frameworks, and she came up with several hypotheses, one of which I found particularly interesting, that anti-abortion, animal rights, and environmental rights extremists are more likely to hoax. So it's not all single-issue groups, but she happened to just grab these single issues and said that, you know, when she was looking at the data, that these groups are more likely than others to implement bomb scares or hoax scares. In order to be included in her data, she said that each of these perpetrator groups needed to be responsible for at least one event that was violent in nature. Her sample was relatively small, and that was one of the flaws that she acknowledged in her data. It was only 75 distinct groups once she got rid of ones that didn't fit her criteria. So she said moving forward, she'd like to acquire more data to really back up whatever correlations that she came up with.
So So, you know, it's funny when you talk about that. I'm wondering, when you're going to do a hoax as a terrorist group, you have to do, it seems to me you'd have to do enough real attacks as well to still be considered credible, right?
Yeah, and what she was saying is that some groups implement hoaxes in between, right? So they want to exhaust law enforcement or exhaust responses. So they will do a hoax, do a real terrorist attack, another hoax, and kind of draw those resources out. And another method for terrorist organizations is to watch how law enforcement responds. They can cater their real attacks so they're more lethal. However, she did find that some groups are more likely to just do hoaxes and not actually commit terrorist attacks.
I wonder if, you know, I think I seem to recall, I don't know though, maybe I'm wrong, is that in the years after 9/11, I seem to recall that, like, Al-Qaeda would make hoax, not really, they weren't really, they would make threats, and then they wouldn't pan out. And it was never really clear, was that sort of an intentional strategy, that they wanted to sort of freak everybody out all the time, or were they hoping to do something and for whatever reason changed their minds, got thwarted, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then just last year, right, ISIS put out a bunch of kill lists, or not ISIS, but their
pro-ISIS
followers
groups,
put out a lot of kill lists, right? And that could kind of be a hoax, kind of, sort of.
I feel like it's kind of the gray area in between where it's kind of like, oh, we'll put it out and it'll still generate fear. And if someone picks up on it, hey, that's great. Then they killed someone on one of these kill lists. And if they don't, it's still kind of scared everyone and it drained all their resources, et cetera. So.
And it seems like, again, even though they didn't put it in terms like this, both Al-Qaeda and ISIS have referenced in their propaganda that very small investments on their part cost us a lot to mitigate those threats a lot, right? So they did it in terms of, I think, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, they had a plot in 2011, 2012. They were trying to put a bomb and printer cartridges on planes.
Mm-hmm.
And it failed, thank goodness, but their big line after that was, oh, we spent, $40,000 and it cost you $40 million to prevent it. And so it's sort of along that same line, right?
Yeah, that same vein for sure. And then when we talk about New Jersey specifically, we had a rash of swatting incidents in 2015 and 2016, which are basically when someone phones in calls in or uses some internet technology to make a false threat, so law enforcement needs to respond. And I've spent some time looking into the motivations of that in terms of criminal activity. So, you know, it's a swatter calling in a hoax bomb threat so they can conduct a robbery. Or is that person not even on the continent and it's not really a threat? So I think one of the fears with swatting on the local level is that a terrorist group will use these hoax calls or these bomb scares in order to monitor law enforcement or in order to attack law enforcement when they're all gathered. So there's always this fear surrounding hoaxes and bomb scares. Yeah. And I think it's really interesting that she's delving into this area because there's really not a lot of research. Like, her lit review was very sparse, and she acknowledged that because there's no existing research being done on it. But I think it says a lot in terms of how we can be prepared as a state if we better understand the motivations behind both criminal organizations using hoaxes and terrorist organizations using them.
Even as pranks, I think every state has this problem. Every June, you know, schools are going to have bomb threats, right? And that's a hoax. And it's either designed to get out of tests, get out of school. But law enforcement agencies have to respond just as much to those as they would if somehow they knew it was, you know, an actual terrorist organization on the other side. So it still, drains the resources and all that. Very cool.
For sure. I like those panels where I can draw it back, like, to us and how we work and how it can help our office.
It's all about us in the end, you know.
There you go. I'll do my next one, and it's not going to nearly be as comprehensive as Paige's rundown, because I don't take nearly as good a notes as that. But I went to a panel called The Changing Nature of Foreign Fighters, and there were a couple speakers there. There were some really, really good ideas wrapped up in that. The first was, one of the speakers was by a researcher. Her name is Mia Bloom. She's doing a lot of really interesting work, and she's been doing research on child soldiers, particularly child soldiers in the Syrian Civil War. And there's certainly been a lot talked about, a lot written about ISIS using children to conduct suicide attacks or just to be used as soldiers. And certainly they do. But what was interesting to me is they're nowhere near the actor who uses children most frequently in combat. Hezbollah, according to her data, far outstrips everybody else in terms of the use of child soldiers. And then I think second place was what's called the Free Syrian Army. And the differences are that ISIS's use, I believe I'm getting this right, she said that's increasing. And ISIS uses their children in sort of different ways. So much like everything else, they've really tried to be very sophisticated in how they use them. So they don't just put a gun in their hands or put them behind the wheel of a vehicle-borne improvised explosive device, but they certainly do that. But they also use children heavily for propaganda. They will take children, indoctrinate them, and then they will put them in mosques to lead prayers, and the message they do, or at least give some sort of sermon, and the message they do is, look, even children understand this, and they use that as a way to sort of shame the men into joining. And they do that sort of video recording as well, you know, when they show the child with the AK-47 or the child behind the wheel of a suicide bomb car, the implicit or maybe explicit call is, why aren't you doing anything? Mm. You know, even these kids are defending the caliphate. Why aren't you? So I thought that was really interesting.
They do the same thing with women. So when Tashfeen Malik, after the San Bernardino shooting, they used that attack to kind of shame the men. Because, like, if this woman is doing this, what is your excuse for not joining the caliphate or conducting an attack on behalf of us? Like, she did it and she died for us. What's your excuse? So,
yeah, exactly. So that's very interesting how they're using that. The other thing, I believe this was also Mia Bloom. She looked at sort of foreign fighters and where they're coming from, and the largest contingent of foreign fighters into the Syrian civil war area of operations are from Tunisia. And when she overlaid that with where children are coming from, they have no record of any children from Tunisia fighting the Syrian civil war. And so her assumption from that is that Tunisia is primarily supplying men. Right. And one of the enticements that ISIS is making to men is, come to the caliphate. We'll give you a wife. We'll give you property. You can start a family and you'll live in utopia. So that message they're positing is working really well in Tunisia. Whereas if you look in sort of other parts of the world, maybe Western Europe, where people are bringing their families as well, the message of the caliphate is a utopia, come here and you'll be able to, you know, live a pious life, that might resonate more with them, you know. So they're really tailoring their recruitment pitch to different regions or even different nationalities. So that seemed like it was pretty interesting as well.
Dean, were you telling us earlier about how certain children are regarded on different levels by the Islamic State? So, you know, if you're a kid that is, you know, from a nation that's, you know, a foreign fighter, that you are maybe not the one to be recruited for a suicide attack because they want to show how diverse they are.
Yeah, so the way Mia talked about it is she called it, I don't know, you guys are probably too young to remember this, United Colors of Benetton. Okay, there you go. Okay, so millennials do know some stuff, so that's great.
Wow.
So, yeah, so when you have foreign fighters, it's very appealing to ISIS propaganda because you can show an Asian child, a Caucasian child, an Arab child, an African child, and it shows that the caliphate is a global enterprise. So those children, highly prized for propaganda, they really don't want to put them in a suicide vest, for example. Those children are sort of the local kids. And some of the examples that were used is, I think it was 2014, maybe early 2015, there's a population in Syria called the Yazidis, which is sort of an ethnic and religious minority. They were brutalized by ISIS. Thousands were taken captive, including lots of children. Some of these children, many of these children, underwent very lengthy brainwashing process. And so now some of those children are being used as suicide bombers. But they don't have the same sort of propaganda value. It's not really worth it to put them in front of a camera. So it's better for them, as they see it, to sort of have them sort of die in combat.
Just throwing it out there, you know, what threat do this younger generation of, like, ISIS brainwashed children, what threat do they pose for us in the future? Is there a way that we can kind of, that they can be de-radicalized? And I hate to throw that term out, but de-radicalized and kind of, like, what's going to happen to them? Are they going to go back with their parents, back to wherever the foreign fighters go, and then eventually become the new generation of foreign fighters? It's just thoughts to think about it. I don't know if any of us really have the answers for it. It's just kind of scary to...
Yeah, because, I mean, you're going to have thousands of people, including children, who are brutalized, and some of whom will have done brutal things. ISIS trains children. They have propaganda video out of them decapitating people, executing people. So that's going to stay with kids probably their whole life. Mm-hmm. The question is that indoctrination going to stick with them, or is that going to be something that they get through, I guess, somehow? Yeah. I imagine there's data, because certainly there are places in Asia and Africa that have had large numbers of child soldiers for long periods of time. So maybe the deciding factor is going to be how long ISIS stays around and can continue to sort of reinforce that indoctrination. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think either way, it's going to be some sort of a public health problem in that region for decades, right?
Yeah. I think with issues in Africa and Asia, for instance, they're more locally based, so there's either civil wars or something that kind of between two different ethnic groups within a specific country. But for ISIS, if they do continue on with that ideological indoctrination and carry that forward growing up, are they going to want to kind of continue on with global jihad and the attacks and everything, instead of it kind of being focused specifically in their area of where they are? So
the other speaker that was really interesting on that panel looked at those people who travel to Iraq and Syria to fight ISIS, particularly Americans who do so. And that very interesting for a couple of reasons. One, it's not illegal to do so, but he had a rather small sample size. I think it was maybe 70 to 100 people they had identified, and they were doing some interviews. What they were able to find was some pretty interesting stuff. First, there were a lot of veterans in this group, and of those veterans who were discharged before the 9/11 attacks, so sort of an older cohort, almost all had been honorably discharged from the service. Most of the people who left the military after 9/11 had not been discharged honorably. So they had been either thrown out, maybe there's a medical condition, disciplinary condition, who knows. But it was very interesting to hear the researcher talk about sort of that very distinct sort of line between the two. Some of the other interesting parts of that is these foreign fighters have a high casualty rate. And also, what was interesting is it's not clear how much of this is, particularly for the, it sounded like from the interviews, from the veterans, how many of this was sort of a need to go back into the fight. So they clearly pointed out that these foreign fighters, they were not loners back in the States. They had spouses, they had partners, they had children, they had jobs in many cases, but in many cases they didn't have jobs that they found fulfilling, or maybe they did have trouble finding jobs. This was seen as a much better alternative for them. They were kind of pulled there. And some of them did it for moral reasons. Some of them just sort of craved to do something military-like. So that was interesting. And they compared that to Europeans who had gone over, where they said Europeans, they detected a stronger strain of sort of far-right ideology, which they didn't really detect in the American cohort.
Huh.
So last bit on that is, I was thinking back to the 1990s in the wake of the civil war in Bosnia, and there were a lot of foreign fighters who went over there. And what happened is, in the wake of that conflict, those foreign fighters, either they weren't ready to reintegrate in society, they couldn't fit back in, whatever. But many of those fighters either converted or linked up with criminal organizations, and that became a nexus of sort of organized crime for quite a long period after that. The researchers didn't think that was going to happen with the Americans, because the Americans who travel over to fight ISIS, they do that individually or maybe in pairs. And so you don't have sort of this cohesive group, whereas in the Bosnian Civil War, you had sort of neighborhoods who would all send people, and people would go over in groups. Mm-hmm. That was that one. Very interesting panel.
So I said it on a panel. The title of it was Alliances and Rivalry Involving Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And the one I liked the most was one by Tricia Bacon from American University. She was presenting her paper on the causes and implications of bipolarity in the Sunni jihadist movement.
What does that mean? That sounds crazy.
So, basically what her argument was, like, counterfactual argument, basically saying, would Al-Qaeda and ISIS have split if bin Laden had still been alive? And she really digs deep into the different leadership styles of Zawahiri versus bin Laden, and she kind of juxtaposes both of them and discusses how Zawahiri deals with things and how bin Laden would have dealt with a similar issue had he still been alive. So essentially the reason that she digs deep into this topic is to assess the different leadership styles. So she's basically making the argument that had bin Laden still been alive, the two would never have split. And because Zawahiri deals with things differently than bin Laden had, he ended up ultimately ruining that relationship, and that's why the split happened. And basically kind of the crux of the argument is that leadership style matters, and they would have been together today had bin Laden still been alive. I actually disagree with that, though, and I think someone did make that argument in the panel, kind of saying that that relationship was already pretty fraught while bin Laden was already alive. And I think I personally think that even had bin Laden still been alive, I think he may have kept it going longer if bin Laden hadn't been the one to explicitly cut ties like Zawahiri did February 2014. Maybe ISIS been the one to kind of be like, we take back our bay'ah to bin Laden, for instance.
And was her point policy-wise about decapitation of terrorist leaders?
She didn't mention decapitation strategy, or either she or someone else mentioned decapitation strategy and basically said we shouldn't just consider the quality of the leader when we're targeting leaders of terrorist organizations, but the quality of the replacement as well.
Mm-hmm.
And what the moderator of that panel, Daniel Byman, was basically advised her to do was write an op-ed saying how we're better off with Zawahiri as the current leader of Al-Qaeda and to not kill him. And he's the best inept leader for Al-Qaeda that we can have. Because
what a compliment.
Well, yeah. And it's, but you think about it, and that's kind of, this is what we want to do. This is the next topic we want to have and discuss amongst ourselves and talk about decapitation strategy and how decapitation strategy affects terrorist organizations.
So let's talk about what is decapitation strategy. Mm.
So decapitation strategy, oh man, I've walked right into that. Decapitation strategy is basically targeting the leadership of certain organizations. And specifically for us, we're talking about killing the leadership of terrorist organizations.
And right, the thought is if you kill the leader, the organization is confused, it can't really function as well. Mm-hmm. And the old cliche is you kill the snake by cutting off the head.
Yeah.
And that things. But there is competing research that says that if you do decapitation strategy, that might actually make the group more resilient, more dangerous,
violent.
More violent. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of controversy.
There's a lot of very valid arguments on both ends of the spectrum when it comes to killing off the leadership and not killing off the leadership. When you look at ISIS, they killed Zarqawi in 2006. The group essentially became more violent, and it is what it is today, back in 2017, a lot worse than it was back in 2006. Reasonable people will disagree. They're going to go back and forth on this. That's really what decapitation strategy is. I just want to go back to, she made some good points about Zawahiri versus bin Laden, and she was saying that Zawahiri really lacked diplomacy. So she's saying bin Laden always had a way of talking things through and providing justification for everything, whether it was a political justification for the cause, whether it was Islamic and theological justification. He was just a lot more prolific and able to articulate things better. And she kind of made a really funny caveat. She's like, I'm not defending bin Laden in any way. I'm just basically saying like how he dealt with things, and his leadership style was a lot better, and he was a lot more charismatic. She said that Zawahiri's justification, or the reasoning the split happened, was basically when the issue rise to the surface, he said, well, don't do it just because I said so. And so when she was talking about the split between Nusra and ISIS, so the point she kept making about Zawahiri was that he was always a better deputy, better than he ever would have been as a leader. So even in his previous leadership roles with Islamic Jihad back in Egypt, he was a better deputy, and then he ended up inheriting the leadership role, and he was still always better as a deputy. So basically that was the whole point of her argument. But I don't necessarily think that I agree, and I think we kind of already discussed that. I think that they would have eventually split, whether it came from Al-Qaeda or whether it came from ISIS.
I think somebody else raised a really good point, which was that whole argument sort of was based on the premise that Al-Qaeda and ISIS sticking together would actually be a good thing for the organization. And in fact, I think you could make a really strong argument that a joined ISIS-Al-Qaeda would have been very bad for Al-Qaeda, just because of a number of problems that the two groups sort of had over the previous you know, 8-10 years. And if you look at what ISIS has done now, it just may have dragged Al-Qaeda down with it even faster.
She acknowledged that it wasn't a good relationship, but she was saying right. it was going to last nonetheless.
Right. All right.
Yeah.
The last presentation that we saw was titled Religion and Terrorism. There was a really interesting study. It still sounds like it's in the early stages. But what the researcher was doing was looking at websites that contained jihadist material and trying to identify what components, what was the stuff on that website that people were clicking on, and then trying to identify what makes a piece of jihadist propaganda or scholarship clickbait worthy, they call it, right? You know, so if you think about on your websites where it says, you know, what are the top 10 celebrities, you know, who are visiting Florida this year, whatever. That's not really a really good clickbait, I guess. But when you see those things on your Facebook account, your Twitter account, you know, click here for the top 10 secrets to lengthen your life, whatever, that's clickbait. And so he was trying to look at sort of this jihadist material on websites and see what about it made it clickbait worthy. Was it the author? Was it the title? Was it that there's something else going on in the world in current events that makes people gravitate towards, you know, this piece of propaganda versus that one? And like I said, very early, it sounded like very early days, but his initial findings seemed to be that the author was the biggest factor in getting somebody to click it.
And that definitely makes sense, right? Because if, like, I published Paige's top 10 favorite vacation spots, but, like, Lady Gaga also published her top 10 favorite vacation spots, like, which one are you going to read?
So Paige's, of course, yeah.
I mean, to me, that wasn't altogether surprising.
Right.
And I think he was saying in one case, like, I forget which jihadist he named, but just because of who that person was, they were always going to get 13 more clicks
right.
than anyone else who wrote about similar content.
But what he, at least on the one sort of site he had looked at, what was interesting is Osama bin Laden was not super high up. Anwar al-Awlaki was not super high up. So that was very interesting.
Well, I think someone pointed out a flaw in it because they opened up the website on their computer and identified that the name of the author isn't even listed. It's just the name of the document and how many clicks and views.
I think that was because of the phone. The viewing it via your cell phone, maybe it's different.
He was on his laptop.
Oh.
And he was like, the author isn't listed. It's just the title of the document. So I'm not sure if you find out the name of the author after you click on it and you find it.
And maybe then it's a word of mouth thing. Like, you have to know, like, that a famous person.
Look at this document, and then this is by so-and-so.
Yeah, it seemed like it was obviously in the initial phases. He started off with this website, I think specifically because he was concerned about formatting, because he was saying there's a ton of research indicating the way things are formatted. That is going to make it more clickable, per se. So he chose this one website specifically because the format was all the same, so he could exclude that variable for now before he tackled other different types of sites.
Now, one of the things that's important to keep in mind, well, I thought it was important. I don't know if he did when I raised it to him, is it's not the same population. So you may have a whole bunch of people who read jihadist literature. You may have people who read all of Osama bin Laden's stuff. There's going to be a small minority of those who are going to commit terrorist attacks. And so this research, as it's sort of formatted, may not tell you a lot about who's going to commit another attack, or, you know, what sort of propaganda will set off an attack. So what would be interesting would be going the other way around, look at that population of people who have committed attacks or tried to commit attacks, and then look at what it is they've clicked on and see, you know, see if there's anything in common there. That would be potentially valuable research.
For sure. And yeah. I think beyond just jihadist literature too, into, like, white supremacist propaganda. Mm-hmm. We know that Dylann Roof was active on a number of different forums and sites. Mm-hmm. For those of you who don't remember, Dylann Roof murdered 9 African Americans at an Episcopal church in South Carolina in 2015. So I think that same perspective on how we approach terrorist propaganda or terrorist literature could cross ideologies.
Oh. So last thing I want to talk about is not really any of the content, but rather the format of this presentation. So we've seen, I don't know, we probably saw 30, each of us probably saw 30 presenters today. And
they all gave roughly 15-minute briefings throughout the day. What are your impressions of that? You guys have given a lot of briefings. What's, I mean, in terms of format or how you compare to how you do it, what do you think?
I think the biggest for me was just the kind of reading off the paper, literally reading off the paper. So some people did excellent job, but I think those were a lot, there were more people were kind of just sticking to their notes. And
I think one of the challenges with presenting academic research is that these people have so much invested in their research, right? And they're super excited about it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's easy to get really caught in the weeds of your, you know, binary variables and, you know, whatever kind of methodology you use. And for like the normal humans, we're kind of like, okay, well, what do you mean? Like, what's the point of that? So I think it's also like drawing yourself out of something you're really excited about to give your audience like the bottom line.
The audience analysis, which is basically what you and I do when we go out, and we want to make sure that if we're speaking to this specific audience, we have to make sure we're breaking down the acronyms if someone doesn't know what an acronym is and explain what the acronym is, explain the context of whatever war or group history you're talking about. But I think most of them forget that, or they don't know that. They just you're like what Paige just said, do they just dive right into this mathematical equation is what led me to and I'm and we're just kind of lost.
Yeah. So yeah, I think definitely, I mean, you could tell a lot of people are nervous. It's probably the first time or one of the first times they're briefing, and that's understandable. But yeah, definitely a little more rehearsal and a focus on a bottom line up front, like what is the takeaway you want them to have. And I was surprised today the number of people who had computer problems for their presentation, which you can tell also threw people off. So we saw a couple people who computers didn't work for them and they were just able to truck on, no problem. And then a couple other people, their presentation wasn't able to come up and that just sort of sunk them. So if anyone's looking for advice, I don't know if they tune in for this for advice, but if you are, you're right, rehearsal. And if you can set up early, practice as close to the way you're actually going to give the presentation as possible, and be prepared for your technology to just not work at all and be able to sort of go off your notes, right?
Yeah, because I think at the end of the day, how much of your research I internalized and what resonates with me has a lot to do with how you present it, if you're excited about it, if it's clear to me. So I think above all, like, you know, doing the preparation is going to help your research actually get into the minds of your audience, which is the whole point.
Yeah. So I think that's it for tonight. Anyone have anything else? All right. Well, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you later.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njhomelandsecurity.gov. If you have any ideas or topics for future episodes, please contact us on Twitter at NJOHSP or email us at intelunclass@njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.